Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and our podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit whose programs include the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. Come visit Bookmarks at our community gathering space and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Today's episode of Inside the Writer Studio is being taped at the recording studio at Summit School in Winston-Salem and available on Screamin' Eagle Radio. Thanks to Henry Heitman and to the staff at Summit for helping with today's recording. My guest today is Frank Morelli, like me, a former teacher here at Summit. Frank's debut novel for young adults, No Sad Songs, was published earlier this month by Fish Out of Water Books. Frank, welcome to Inside the Writer Studio.
Thanks for having me, Charlie. It's great to be here.
So let's talk about your background a little bit first. You are a teacher. You were working as a teacher when you started working on this book. What subject, what grade level do you teach, and what made you want to move from teaching to writing?
Well, I've always been a middle school teacher, and sixth grade was really where I spent most of my time, eighth grade as well. But I really have taught pretty much every grade within the middle school sphere. Some people tell me that I'm kind of crazy and that I must have like some kind of sadistic death wish for doing that. But I really found that teaching is actually the reason why I'm a writer. I gain inspiration from the students every single day. They teach me things that I never could learn from adults because I think they see through a lot of the garbage that we're oftentimes masked by. And I think that really, if I hadn't become a teacher, the writing thing never would have happened. So my experience here at Summit was really a special one. The students here are ultra creative. They really get into the writing aspect of things. And in my time, I really tried to make writing exciting for them, and in doing that, it was kind of like a payback to myself. Their excitement created an excitement within me, and it drove me to kind of keep writing. So, I would say that teaching and writing kind of go hand in hand for me.
Yeah. So, those of you listeners may not know this, but Frank and I not only both worked at Summit School, but we both worked on the title of writer in residence. So we both had that experience of writing in a school environment and that kind of interaction that you talked about with our students. I was a playwright, so I was working with students who would literally come to me and say, hey, I think this could be better if you did it this way or if you did it that way. So you really had that opportunity not only to be inspired by your students, but to sometimes even collaborate.
I mean, there's nothing like getting feedback and oftentimes criticism from an 11-year-old student.
Exactly.
And then looking back and saying, they're right.
So tell me about how you became writer in residence and what that meant while you were working on No Sad Songs.
Well, I've been trying to get published and publish a novel for a long time, really since the beginning of my teaching career, which is about 15 years ago. And writing and teaching and writing in any kind of job at the same time, they really don't work together very well. Teaching is probably the best occupation you can do if you want to be able to write, because you do have some time off in the summer. But when it comes down to it, during the school year, you're really kind of saddled with grading and planning, and really at the end of every day, you're pretty tired. So a couple years ago, I was getting to the point where I realized that if I continued on the same path, that I was never going to reach this dream that I've had. And I went to Michael Ebeling. To his credit, he is probably one of the most open-minded bosses that I've ever had in my life. Great head of school. I told him what I was thinking. I told him that I was thinking about leaving the profession altogether. And he kind of talked me down off the tower a little bit. He told me that he wanted me to think about how I can still continue to be involved in school and also be able to live out my dream. So he offered me this opportunity to kind of ease back on the amount of classes that I was taking, that I was teaching, and to continue writing, even when I was here sometimes, but a lot of times doing it from home. And it really made all the difference. I was on a tear last year with writing. I finished about three first drafts of novels that I'm developing right now. And I got No Sad Songs signed and started to promote it and think about how I was going to let the world know that it existed. So without people helping you like that, it's really hard to kind of break in to a profession like this. So I'm really thankful for that. But being a writer in residence, and you could probably attest to this, Charlie, it's a really, really interesting job because you have a chance to travel around and see what's happening in different classrooms. You have a chance to work with different grade levels and see how writing improves from 6th grade to 7th grade to 8th grade. It really gives you a good overall view of how students learn how to write. Yeah. And you can kind of see the process taking place right in front of your eyes.
Yeah, I worked with 3rd graders and then with 8th and 9th graders in the theater arts department. But my experience was sort of similar to yours in terms of crafting that position. I had written one play for 3rd graders. The head of the upper school asked me, would I write a play for the upper school? And so I went to the then head of school, Sandra Adams, and said, hey, I'm going to write plays for you, and you need to call me writer in residence. And so that's sort of how that started. So let's talk about No Sad Songs a little bit. No Sad Songs is your first book. Can you tell us basically give me the elevator pitch, as we say in the business, for the novel?
Definitely. It's a story that really is kind of based on my own experiences a little bit. When I was a teenager myself, my grandfather was diagnosed with a form of Alzheimer's called Pick's disease, and it's the kind of Alzheimer's that you can get when you're even like 40 years old. So he was reasonably young. I think he was probably in his late 50s or so when we started to first notice the signs of it. And I had an unfortunate chance, to see my father and my mother act as his caregivers, and it was really heartbreaking to see the man who, you know, had raised my father, now being raised by my father. It was kind of a reversal that I'll never be able to forget. And I always kind of felt a little guilty about the fact that I couldn't really do anything. I was just a teenager. I felt like helpless in the situation. And years later, I talked to my father about it, and he told me that he also felt helpless when he was even the caretaker himself. So it always kind of sat there in my mind, you know, what would have happened if I was like 17, 18 years old and, you know, my parents weren't there to take that responsibility. I know I'm the type of person that would have tried to take on the burden of helping my grandfather, but I know that I wasn't equipped to do it. At the time, I was lucky if I made it to school on time. I was lucky if, you know, I made the baseball team. I was happy about that. So I couldn't imagine trying to juggle that anchor. So I wanted to try to write a story where I explored that. That's really where it came from. Mm-hmm. And my protagonist, Gabe Lascuda, he has just turned 18. His parents are involved in an accident, and he loses them early on in the book. And he's now left with his grandfather, and he wants to take on the responsibility. He doesn't want his grandfather to end up in a facility just like his father didn't want to happen. So he tries to keep this promise to his father throughout the book. And he also tries to juggle just being a regular teenager, just, you know, fighting through the awkwardness, trying to meet girls, trying to make his grades, trying to make baseball teams. And it's just, you know, it sounds kind of sad, but when it comes down to it, there's some humorous elements to it that really bring the story together and really kind of harken back to how my family and I were able to get through the situation that we did. It was just kind of being able to laugh in the moments when that was appropriate.
Yeah, I think one of the things that struck me about this novel is the way it puts the typical struggles of teenagedom into some perspective, because all the other kids around him are, as you said, trying to meet girls, trying to make the baseball team, trying to pass a test, write an essay, and he's doing all those things, and at the same time, he has this much larger responsibility that's looming over him, and it kind of makes us all think about things in relationship to that. Would you share a little bit of the book with us, read a passage?
Sure. Let me set it up a little bit. One of the elements of the story is that Gabe, he's been given a personal essay assignment where he kind of has been asked by his teacher to connect poetry that they're learning to events in his life and to be able to reflect on them. So the way that I was able to do that was to actually include the actual essays in there. So I want to share one of the essays that actually is probably one of my favorites because it does connect to some memories that I have from my own life as well. It's called Leather and Pipe Tobacco. Put your face in it, Gabe. Really get your nose in there. Grandpa slid the glove off his weathered hand and dropped down to one knee. There was a twinkle in his eye. The sun sparkled off gray strands that poked out from beneath his brown mane. It was the first time I ever saw him smile, and even then I had to look pretty hard as he fought to banish it from his face. Dad stood a few steps behind, silent, a goofy grin plastered on his face. It was like they'd already shared this moment and relished in their chance to relive it, like they'd been waiting for it to happen every day since the last. Go ahead, Gabe. Give it your best stuff. Grandpa pushed the heavy piece of rawhide against my chest. I took hold and slipped my left hand inside. It felt slick with Grandpa's sweat, My fingers barely reached the holes they were destined to fill one day. Gramps and Dad had spent most of the morning pounding their fists into the pocket, slathering it with oil, and contorting it into all sorts of painful-looking shapes. Grandpa pushed the glove up toward my face. "Go ahead, son. It's yours now." I inhaled, and my lungs were filled with the rich scent of tanned leather, the defining moment that lures a youngster to the game from the very first time his hand reaches inside a mitt. My eyes bulged, and my mouth puckered into a tiny 3-year-old O. "There it is, Dad. You see that?" And Gramps and Dad burst out into proud and joyous laughter. Grandpa tussled my hair with his aging hand, and the scent of pipe tobacco mingled with the lingering glove leather. He pinched my nose between his knuckles and said, "Don't forget to keep it clean now, kid." It was the first time I ever heard him utter the phrase. "Let's toss the old ball around," Grandpa said, once the moment had been thoroughly savored. Dad and Grandpa pulled their gloves, cracked and scuffed by decades of use, out from the backs of their waistbands. They slipped them on and popped the pockets a few times with clenched fists. "Watch and learn, Gabe," Grandpa said, as he flipped a sidearm toss over to Dad, who squeezed it in the pocket and covered it up with his throwing hand. "Always use two hands. Your father learned that lesson a few times." Dad shook his head and kept throwing. "Look the ball into the glove, and for Pete's sake, Gabe, stay in front of the damn thing. It's a ball, not a bomb." Dad shook his head again, but kept throwing and catching. "Now it's your turn, Gabe." Grandpa knelt down and put his hands on my shoulders. He jostled me around a bit until I was in the right position, and then he took a few steps back and held the ball out in front of his chest. "You ready?" I didn't know what to say, so I just nodded and held my glove in front of my face. My eyes barely peeked over the webbing. "Here goes." And Grandpa wound back and tossed the ball. The top half caught the sun and gleamed in white. The bottom half was the dark side of the moon. The laces flipped and twirled, and I fought hard to keep myself from jumping out of the way and disappointing Grandpa. Then I felt leather make contact with leather. The weight gathered in the pocket. There was a soft snap as my bare hand clamped over the front of the glove. "Would you look at that? My grandson's a freaking natural." "The next Willie Mays," Dad said. "The next Willie Mays." I often think about moments like these, the ones that feel so light and carefree at the time, but that carry with them much heavier insights. It's only in the future, after time has beaten the ever-loving crap out of you, that you realize what was actually taking place on a day like that. And it reminds me of one of Robert Frost's most famous poems, which also happens to appear in one of my favorite books of all time, The Outsiders. I may have read S.E. Hinton's most popular book way back in middle school, but I will never forget the sage insight Johnny Cade gives Ponyboy through Frost's words. They still ring in my ears. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. Her early leaf's a flower, but only so an hour. Then leaf subsides to leaf, so Eden sank to grief. So dawn goes down today, nothing gold can stay. When the ball popped my mitt that day, so many years ago, when I could barely see over the shoulders of a cricket, and I squeezed it before it flipped lifelessly to the grass, I had held on to more than just the ball. I had held that gold in my hand, the hardest hue. And Gramps and Dad recognized it immediately, for they had once held the same hue in their own hands. Their appreciation for the gift that had been mysteriously stolen from them, their youth, was the catalyst for all the smiles and laughter these two produced in my honor. But for them, that first youthful hue was far behind them, just a distant blip that wouldn't even register on a satellite image. For them, dawn had long ago gone down today, and the only gold they'd see again would exist within the DNA they had passed along to me. These days, I'm not even sure I possess the hue anymore. I'm 18 years old, and for me, the light is already starting to fade. But I'm lucky. For Gramps and for Dad, men whose youth and energy once injected jolts of electricity into anything they touched, the flame has already been extinguished. And nothing they, or I, or even God could do would ever change that fact.
So that lovely scene where the grandfather is giving him his baseball glove takes place in, as most of your novel does, in suburban Philadelphia. Why did you choose that particular setting, and how do you think that setting shaped the story?
Well, I'm actually from Philadelphia myself, and for me, Philadelphia is a place that reminds me of this experience. So I thought that helped me to be more equipped to tell the story. But it also is because Philadelphia, to me, represents a place that's really blue-collar, people that are hardworking, and people that oftentimes will set aside their own desires so that they can help other people. That's always been my experience of people in that area. The city doesn't get a lot of credit for things like that. In fact, oftentimes our sports fans are viewed as being less than sportsmanlike. But my experience in the city of Philadelphia is that there's a reason why it's called the city of brotherly love. And I feel like Gabe Lascuda really typifies that point, especially the fact that his friends are major factors in helping him to be able to hold the burden of his grandfather up and to do the right thing for him. So to me, Philadelphia just seemed like the perfect place for me to set this, and it definitely shaped the way my characters kind of treated each other throughout the story.
Yeah. So then, as we probably have guessed, with the scene and with the baseball glove, sports and baseball in particular figure well into this novel. And I'm thinking sports, Philadelphia, anything interesting happening at that combination lately?
Not much, except for 39 years worth of waiting.
Because I have to say, you know, I read your novel literally days before the Super Bowl. So like sports and Philadelphia were both very much on my mind as we moved into that memorable weekend.
I have to say, Charlie, it's been a pretty amazing month because, yeah, I am a major Eagles fan. I tell people that being born in Philadelphia means that you're basically legally bound to root for all the teams, even when they're terrible, which is most of the time. So I've been waiting. I'm 39 years old now, and I've been waiting literally 39 years for the Eagles to be able to win the Super Bowl. And it winds up happening 2 weeks before my other dream, which was to have a book release. So right. It was just kind of a lot to take in, and been a pretty happy February.
So let's talk about Gabe for a minute. Gabe lives with his uncle and his grandfather at the beginning of the book, but for different reasons, he can't really be close to or closely connected with either one of them. And so I feel like in a narrative sense, it's almost like he doesn't have a family at the beginning of the book. And in this way, he reminds me of my own hero, Peter Byerly, in The Bookman's Tale, who we meet at the beginning as a very isolated widower. What do we accomplish narratively by isolating our characters like that?
That's a great question. Well, first of all, it forces the reader to be able to focus in directly on that character's plight. And that's really what I wanted people to see. I wanted people to be able to understand just how alone Gabe felt. Even though he wasn't actually alone, even though he definitely had a support system, he felt like the responsibility was solely on him. So being able to isolate your character allows you to kind of really ratchet that up and create a feeling for the reader that you have a character that is almost lost. Which Gabe definitely is early on in the story. It takes him a long time before he realizes that he has people there to support him and that he needs to accept their help. I would say that it was definitely a very intentional decision to make Gabe's parents only be in the story for very short bursts of time and most of the time through his reflections, because that's the way he feels about it now. He feels like they're farther away from him than they've ever been.
So it seems, as I was reading your book, I thought about this. It seems to me almost a rule in fiction, this unwritten rule that young protagonists like Gabe always speak to us in the first person. It goes back to David Copperfield. We see it in Huck Finn, and we see it in Catcher in the Rye, where Salinger even references David Copperfield at the beginning of the book, To Kill a Mockingbird. Why do you think so many writers use the first person with young protagonists, and why did you choose to use the first person?
Well, one of the reasons why I choose the first person is because of me just observing students, and I, you know, I've had a chance to teach students reading for a long time, and I just notice what they gravitate towards. I believe that younger people are able to put themselves in somebody else's shoes more easily than they are, you know, a third person type of narrator that's not physically there. Mm-hmm. So I felt like I needed to make them tangible. I also feel like, and one of my favorite. One of my favorite aspects about a book like The Catcher in the Rye is the voice. Yeah. Being able to attach to that voice and a voice that might sound like people that are standing all around you, like your friends, like what you might hear in the hallway, creates a sense of authenticity that I don't think you can reproduce in a third-person narrative. So I feel comfortable writing in the first person. I have written a number of things in the third person as well, but I always feel like I can lose myself in the character and be able to communicate better in their voice than in my own.
Yeah, I think what you say about voice is really true, especially with younger protagonists. I mean, I if I think about Holden Caulfield, if I think about Scout Finch, I mean, those voices are just in my head. I can't you can't shake them out.
Two of my favorite narrators.
And I think the reason those are our favorite narrators is because the authors nailed the voice so precisely, and as you say, so authentically.
One of the things I love about Scout too is just is how oblivious she is to a lot of the adult situations that are happening around her. So I think using the first person, especially with a younger narrator, it gives you the opportunity to show that there's not an awareness of what's happening, but there's more of an observational transaction happening there.
Sure. I mean, I think that to me that's especially true of Huck in Huck Finn. You know, that he is the sort of the ultimate unreliable narrator. Did you see Gabe as an unreliable narrator, or is, you know, we obviously, depending on who's reading that novel, whether it's being read by a young person or an adult, they might have different views of how reliable Gabe is as a narrator.
I felt like I was trying to make him unreliable intentionally, especially in that he views certain things in the book. I don't want to get into too much detail about it, but he views certain things in the book in a way that's not necessarily accurate. He doesn't feel like the way that his friends are supporting him is the right way to be supporting a friend, but he's blinded by the fact that he doesn't understand the trouble that he's getting himself into by not right. accepting the help. So I feel like the way that he talks about his friends, especially in the book, is very unreliable. It creates a sense of again aloneness that he's set apart from everybody because he has this burden.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are definitely moments in the book where I just wanted to smack him upside the head, which I think is a good thing. I mean, anytime your reader feels emotionally engaged to the point that they want to smack your character upside the head, that means you have made that person real. I've had that experience of people talking to me about my characters, and I kind of have to step back and go, wow, these people think that these are actually real people in the book that I'm writing about.
When I was still in the first draft of this and I was sending it out to readers, I got that remark back a number of times. You know, Gabe is not a person that I like as much as I should. And there was a part of me that wanted to make the change, that I wanted to listen to the advice. But then every time I kept going back, I kept thinking, you know, I don't really want people to like him 100% because that's not real. You know, everybody has aspects of themselves that others might notice as being not optimal. And Gabe has that. And that's one of the things that I like about him most.
Well, I mean, to me, Gabe is one of those characters who I like him as a person. I don't necessarily like all the decisions that he makes or the choices that he makes, which is, yeah, as you said, that's very, very true to life. I think I talk a lot about writing characters who have almost paradoxical aspects to them. The hero of the Lost Book of the Grail, Arthur Prescott, is a guy who goes to church every day but doesn't believe in God. You know, and a lot of readers are like, I don't get that. But they start to think about it. It's like, well, no, that makes him a much more interesting person than if it were more sort of the obvious. He does exactly what you expect him to do.
It definitely adds complexity.
So you use the first person, but you also in the narrative chapters use the present tense. Can you talk about why you chose to do that?
I wanted people reading it to understand what Gabe felt like in real time as he was going through this experience. And as he, you know, there's a number of events in the book where he deals with the idea of being awkward or feeling embarrassed by this old guy that's basically following him around everywhere. And I wanted people to understand how he felt from moment to moment, to feel like it was currently happening to Gabe. I didn't want people to feel like he had been reflecting on it. I also felt like if I was going to use the personal essays in there to reflect upon things in his past, that I needed to keep the rest of the story, you know, happening in the present time and being immediate, if I wanted people to be able to understand the reflections that Gabe was making at the same time.
Sure. So let's talk about that structure for a minute. You alternate, for the most part, back and forth between one or two or three chapters that are in the present tense and then one of these essays that he's written for his English class. How does that allow you to claim sort of a narrative freedom that you wouldn't have if you were just writing a more traditional through-line narrative?
Well, it doesn't force me to have to use the narrative of Gabe to keep on telling us, like, here's what happened in my past. It allows to creates a sense of authenticity, so that these realizations are happening in real time because he's doing this personal essay project. But he is being able to tell us backstory, which makes you understand that, you know, these events did happen in the past, but they are still relevant to his present and even to his future. One of the main decisions I made and the reasons why I decided to use the essays is because, as a person myself, I'm the kind of person that I don't learn things quickly. I have an experience, and then sometimes, like, 2 or 3 months later, I'll have this like burst, like, oh, this means this, or I'll take something from it that is much beyond the moment when it happened. So I felt like Gabe was the kind of character that also would have been able to use this experience that he's currently going through to think about things that he may not have thought about his past when they were happening, that they are now coming up. So it almost even kind of shows this maturity that he's starting to kind of move towards as the book goes forward as well.
I think one of the things that I liked about the essays is that we were talking about voice a minute ago, and it allows you to have some sort of variety of voice. The narrative chapters are very much in Gabe's day-to-day voice. It sounds like you're talking to a teenager. Whereas, as we all know from being teachers, when kids are writing an essay for a teacher, they're going to be a little bit more formal. They're going to be a little bit more structured. And so you not only are alternating, you know, a present day through line narrative with these moments of reflection, but you're able to alternate the structure some as well. And to me, that kind of it avoids what could have fallen into a monotony of voice if you sort of had that same voice page after page after page, and gives us a little more variety.
Yeah, it took a long time to get it to that point. A very intentional thing. I really had fun playing with the different voices that I was going to use. I needed to learn what kind of an essayist is this kid? What kind of a person is he when he talks to his friends? And you're right. You're 100% right. Those are two very different things. And in the classroom, you see that happening constantly.
So you're writing this book and also doing some teaching at the same time. Did you ever give your students the assignments that you imagined Gabe was receiving that caused him to write these essays?
Not exactly the assignments, but definitely personal essay type of reflection assignments. Yeah, and in fact, while I was writing it, it was fun to see how my students responded to similar questions about their pasts, and it actually did help me to see how I knew their voices from literally hearing them every 5 seconds in my classroom, so to then be able to see the difference between how they told a story to me. In fact, one of the assignments that I did is that I had students tell a story by word of mouth, and it was interesting to see how when they told their story, it was very different from when they wrote their story. Yeah. So that did actually help me a little bit, and in fact, I didn't even realize that until you just asked me that question.
So Gabe, and also one of his favorite teachers, loves poetry. We heard you cite that wonderful Robert Frost poem, "Nothing Gold Can Stay," in the essay that you just read. Talk about how and why you incorporated that love of poetry into the book, and how you used it to sort of tease out these emotional moments for Gabe.
I think that you just said it right there. I think that poetry gives you the opportunity to tease things out in smaller bursts, and you can get a broader idea of issues that you're trying to tackle in your story by being able to connect it to a line of poetry instead of an entire, you know, something in that's much bigger than that. But another real reason why I decided to use poetry a lot was because the book also has a lot of music in it, and for myself, yeah. I see a huge connection between music and poetry. I love music. I love listening to lyrics and kind of studying them. And it's amazing to see the comparison between some kind of, you know, grunge music that you may have listened to in like 1994, and then going back and looking at an Emily Dickinson poem and seeing similar ideas in there.
Yeah, I've had this very strange experience as a child of the 70s, and now we have this digital radio with this incredibly clear signal, and I'm understanding lyrics of songs that I've heard 1,000 times before, but never knew what the guys were singing. It's really it's one of the advantages of modern technology and aging. So have you had that experience with your own students of them connecting poetry to their lives, making those connections?
To be 100% honest with you, I always find that there's a pushback against poetry, especially like in middle school. I think students feel intimidated by it because they feel like there's a lot of decoding that they need to do. So one of the reasons why I did want to even implement more poetry into the story is because it was my hope that when students read this, that they'll have more of a connection to the poetry and see that there are things communicating to them from the deep past that humans have been talking about for years and hundreds of years. So yeah. I actually have, you know, some of my students actually came in to my classroom the other day after reading my book with Robert Frost book, so I was feeling pretty good about that.
That's nice. So Gabe, at one point in the book, faces a fairly complex moral dilemma. And it, to me, it sort of follows, again, in the tradition of a lot of young protagonists who have had that sort of dilemma to face, from Huck Finn to Harry Potter, and who have, in the process of that, to some extent or another, discovered the idea that there is a level of morality that is above the written rules and laws of society. Without giving away the game too much, can you talk a little bit about how Gabe explores that dilemma?
Well, everything that drives him in this story, I think, goes back to his desire to want to keep his promise to his father, which he never actually makes by word of mouth. It's really more of a promise that he has in his heart, and the promise is that he's going to basically allow his grandfather to kind of live out the rest of his life in dignity, and for him that means not having to turn him over to somebody who might be better equipped to take care of him. So for Gabe, there's a bit of an immaturity there. There's a pushback to want to kind of see what is the right thing to do, because the right thing to do is to actually have his grandfather being taken care of by professionals, because he's at that level. So for me, it was kind of allowing Gabe to take that journey, and through some of the interactions with his friends, be able to realize that his promise was maybe a promise that he was unable to keep from the beginning, and that sometimes we all make promises like that are unable to be kept. So it was more of Gabe trying to reach a level of acceptance for what his limits were.
Yeah. I mean, I like the way that his friends, I think, more than he does, realize that he's kind of in this moral gray area. He at the beginning sees things in pretty black and white. Like you said, either I am doing what I promised to do with my grandfather, or I'm not. There's no real in between. But so many people in a support system, both friends and adults, recognize that it's more complicated than that. And I like watching him gradually start to understand that, because to me, you know, that is what growing up and being a teenager is all about, is starting to learn that the world isn't just black and white, that it's mostly gray, you know.
And one of Gabe's things too is that he wants to be the hero, you know. And I knew a lot of people in my life, myself included, that want to try to be the hero, even if it's impossible to be that.
Right. There's a point in the book where Gabe describes a character, and I'm going to quote directly because I think this is a great quote, and I want you to talk to me about it. He says, "She's just Gabe Lasuda, like the rest of us." So, in what way are all of us Gabe Lasuda?
Again, I think it goes back to our desire to want to keep the people around us safe, and sometimes being able to having the desire to overextend ourselves. I feel like I've always overextended myself. You know, I'm a person that has trouble saying no to things, even when I know that I can't live up to it. And for Gabe, that's one of the things that he's living with throughout the entire story. So I feel like everybody's kind of like Gabe, because they want to do that. They want to be able to do the right thing all the time. And they beat themselves up about it when they're unable to achieve that, even if it's an impossible fact. And there's nothing that you can do to get there. A person with Alzheimer's, and most forms of Alzheimer's, are really even hard to slow down once they take root. There's really no cure. So it's almost an inevitability. And when you set yourself up against a promise that can't be made, it becomes easy to allow that promise to help make your life unravel. So I think for many of us, that happens. And I've known a lot of caretakers besides my parents as well. And I know how it takes over, how the disease winds up taking over their lives, even when they don't have it. And I know how much they beat themselves up when they're unable to cure the person that they love, even though they went into it knowing there isn't a cure. So in that respect, I feel like we all kind of can connect to Gabe, wanting to be that hero, wanting to be that person that you know, everybody looks up to and says, you know what, you did the right thing. You lived up to your promises. You lived up to everything you said. But sometimes that's impossible.
Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately what we're trying to do when we're creating characters is to create someone who is at the same time just like us and yet like nobody we've ever met before. And if you can accomplish that paradox, then you've created a good character that people can relate to but are also going to be interested in and curious about. So having listened to what you said about music, I can make a guess about the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask you anyhow, which is, talk to me about the title. I mean, I've personally had strange experiences with titles. I've had four books that have come out from Penguin, and only one of them was published under the title that I originally submitted it. But talk to us about how you came up with the title. Was this your original working title, or does it have a history?
It went through so many different titles since the first draft. I can't even remember what the original title was at this point. Yeah. It changed to Twice Five Miles at some point. I don't even know how that even ties into the book anymore, because the book has changed so often. But one thing is I wanted to do is make sure that the title and the poetry kind of echoed back and forth against each other. Right. So the title does come from a poem, which I won't talk about too much because it's one of the main ones towards the end of the story. But it also kind of gives us this idea that, you know, even when things in our life are sad and look like they're insurmountable, that there really are some rays of light around that. And it's a lot of times the people around us that are looking out for us. So for me, I wanted to create a title that not only connected to the poetry, but that also kind of shed some positivity on what's a pretty heavy subject matter.
Yeah. So one of the things I admired about this book, we talk a lot down at Bookmarks about trying to find books that display ethnic and cultural diversity, that show characters of color in a positive light. And you do have a pretty diverse cast here. Was that a decision of I'm going to do this, or did that emerge more organically from your place in your story? How did you get that diversity into your novel?
It wasn't really something that I was thinking about going into it, because I don't like to try to create a story based on like trends or trying to do something that is not in my own personal experiences. So for me, it kind of grew organically. But as I started to write and create these characters, I started to really think about Philadelphia, and the story is set there, and there's a really diverse culture in Philadelphia. The city is, you know, filled with people of all different backgrounds. All the people I went to school with were from different backgrounds. So I decided to kind of draw on not really actual, like 100% actual people that I knew, but maybe a mashup of many people that I knew. So really, it wound up just kind of reflecting what I knew of the city and what I knew of the different, you know, ethnic and cultural backgrounds of people from there.
So baseball. Let's talk about baseball for a second. He's smiling, those of you who can't see through the radio. Gabe's a baseball player. He's a baseball fan. But when I started, you know, reading some of the baseball scenes in the novel, I can't help but be reminded of the way baseball has been used metaphorically in American literature. I mean, it seems to me as no other sport. I mean, I think of books like The Natural or films like Field of Dreams, you know, where there's this very simple sport that seems to have this deep, resonant, metaphorical meaning in American culture. Did you see it as metaphorical in your book? And if so, how? How did you use baseball, and what did it mean to you?
Very much so. In fact, I like to use sports as metaphors all the time. I even write a column for Change 7 magazine that's based upon that whole idea. But the idea of using baseball in there is because I feel like baseball is such a generational game. It connects generations. Mm-hmm. It's not like a sport where, you know, just young people are really interested in it. I can remember going to baseball games and having my father and my grandfather and my uncle. And it was just a place where we were able to connect on so many different levels. Even when we didn't understand things about each other, we could always go to the ballpark and talk about baseball. And a lot of times those conversations may have been about baseball, but they were about so many other things.
Yeah.
So in this book, I wanted to use baseball to connect the three generations of Lascutas, Gabe, his father, and his grandfather. I think you probably saw that in the essay that I just read. They all kind of have this connection to the sport. They all kind of see it as a way to kind of gain freedom in a way, and also a way to make an understanding of just the normal everyday things that happen in your life. I firmly believe, and this might sound ridiculous to people who aren't really into sports, but I played on a lot of different teams throughout my life, and I firmly believe that there is a baseball situation for just about any situation in life.
So I want to circle back just for 1 minute before we finish up to the fact that you were teaching and writing at the same time. Did you share what you were working on with your students? Did you get their reactions to individual essays or chapters or even just ideas that you were playing around with in No Sad Songs?
I did. Especially the first chapter. The first chapter of the book is literally the first piece of young adult literature I'd ever written, so I didn't really know what kind of reception it would get. So I did read that aloud to some of my students. I used it as an example. I can't remember the exact activity that we did, but I used it as a piece of like an artifact in the class that we were studying for one of the class periods. And it was kind of cool to hear the feedback. They all liked the story. I didn't tell them that I had written it until after the fact.
Oh, interesting.
So, because I didn't want them to just be like, yeah, this is my teacher. This is great. So they gave me pretty good feedback on it. And I was, you know, when you're reading something to somebody, you can always tell when they're really locked in. So they were kind of locked into the chapter, and it really made me think, wow, maybe there's something to this. And it really drove the rest of my story for me in terms of motivation and inspiration. I tried not to share actual parts of the book with them anymore, but I did oftentimes ask them little things about characters. And like when I was creating Gabe, you know, would you think that a character would do this, and see what they would say? So, yeah, I mean, having the ability to be in the classroom while you're writing a book that's meant for children, it's got to be one of the, it's like finding a pot of gold.
Yeah, I think, you know, last year I was working on a book for middle graders, and when I was about two-thirds of the way through, we were on a choir trip with our church, and we had all these middle grade kids, and it just evolved that every night in our hotel room I was reading them a chapter out of this book. And it not only did it help me write the end of the book, but you, as you said, you could immediately see what was working and what wasn't working. And they're like 10, 11, 12 years old. They are not shy about raising their hand and saying, that character did something different in the last chapter that doesn't make sense with what's going on in this chapter. And they're great critics.
I was going to say the same. I mean, kids are not going to lie to you. They're going to tell you the truth. They're not going to candy coat things for you. And usually whatever they see is pretty accurate. You know, it's not going to be shaded by, hey, I want to make you feel good. Right. They just want to let you know what they see in the story, and they're just going to be honest. So great resource. And it was also kind of cool to be able to include them in the process, because now that the book is out and they're actually reading it, they remember some of the things that I actually share with them.
So have you gotten some feedback from kids who finished reading the book?
I actually have. One of my students actually sent me an email at midnight, and then the night of the launch, saying that she had finished the book, and I was just absolutely great. Over the moon to hear it.
Yeah, that's great. So we like to end every episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same 10 questions. They're all short answers, and since you're a teacher, we're not going to call this a quiz, but you know, we're going to hope that it gives us a little bit of insight into you and to your process. So here we go. This is the speed round. What word do you love to work into your writing?
This isn't going to be surprising. Philadelphia.
What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
Most of the time, adverbs, but specifically the word consistently, which for some reason feels like one of the longest and slowest words of all time.
Where's your favorite place to write?
Honestly, I would say my favorite place to ever write was on the rooftop of a New York City brownstone where I used to live, because it was so quiet and there was nobody else up there. But I don't have that opportunity anymore. So I'm kind of unlike a lot of writers. I usually try to find the quietest and most enclosed area I can go to, one that doesn't really have a lot of windows, because I get easily distracted and I like to kind of just go inside my head.
Where could you never write?
A crowded coffee shop, like every other writer.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
I think I'm the king of using one-word sentences, and I use a lot of sentence fragments in there, especially when I'm trying to create a certain character's voice. But I kind of like doing it, so I'm not going to stop.
What was the first book you remember reading?
Well, I don't know if it was the very first book I've ever read, but the first novel that made an impression on me and turned me into a reader was The Adventures of Tom Sawyer.
Mm-hmm. What are you reading now?
Right now, I'm reading a book that just came out early this month by a debut author as well. His name's Michael Farrow. It's called Title 13.
What book would you like to have written?
Wow. Probably The Outsiders. I feel like it's the best work of young adult literature that's ever existed. But if not that, I guess I'd settle for To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah. Settle for To Kill a Mockingbird? What sort of book would you like to write but probably never will?
I've always wanted to write a dystopian novel because I'm so into the reading dystopian novels. I like how it kind of connects to history and how it connects to our, you know, current times. But I just don't know that I'm equipped to write that kind of story.
And finally, what would you like to hear a reader tell you?
I just want to hear them tell me that they enjoyed the book and that they had some kind of connection to people who are caretakers, because, I mean, there's about 15 million people in the United States doing that job right now without anybody knowing it.
This has been Inside the Writer's Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and the podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a new community gathering place and independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. To find out more about Bookmarks and all its programs, visit www.bookmarksnc.org. My guest today has been Frank Morelli, whose new novel, No Sad Songs, is available wherever books are sold. And of course, you can get signed copies from Bookmarks. Frank, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Charlie. I appreciate you having me.
Coming soon on Inside the Writer's Studio, I'll be talking with Elaine Neal Orr about her new novel, Swimming Between Worlds, set right here in Winston-Salem. Until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.